Yep. So, for our listeners, it's 7:24 a.m. here in Melbourne, and we are going to be talking with Drew Pendergrass, who is the co-author of Half Earth Socialism, a plan to save the future from extinction, climate change, and pandemics. He wrote this together with Troy Vitess, I think that's how you pronounce his surname. Drew is a climate scientist and activist. He's a PhD student in environmental science at Harvard University, and he is here with us. Good morning, Drew.
Good morning to you guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Our pleasure. So, Drew, would you describe yourself as a fighter for all living beings, just not just human beings? And why do you feel this way? Do you think other socialists should also feel that way?
Yeah, thank you for this question. I would describe myself that way. It's so this book that you mentioned that I co-wrote, it's a book that tries to do a lot of things, and among them, one of the arguments that we try to make is that, as a practical matter, in terms of solving the environmental crisis, reducing the amount of meat and animal products in the food system is enormously helpful in solving a lot of environmental problems. And that's how I personally came to becoming a vegan, is that I, as a scientist, saw all this sort of data about the scale of how animal agriculture has affected the planet. Something like half of the Earth's surface land is used for agriculture. This is really quite dramatic, and this is compared to it's producing quite a small amount of GDP, and the vast majority of that goes to animal agriculture. So, I mean, this is something that, you know, I felt as a scientist that I needed to, as a practical matter, change about my life in the same way that I try not to drive, etc. But in adopting this practice, I've become quite open to some of the more moral arguments for vegetarianism and veganism, in terms of you know, this idea of you know, when you try and justify, I think, you know, eating animals, and you don't have, I would say, a good reason. So I'm not an indigenous person or anything. I don't have any like strong cultural reason to eat animals or something. Anytime I would try and justify, you know, eating meat, it would sound kind of fascist, like, you know, there's a traditional reason that we should be eating this, or it's what we've always done, or, you know, we humans are better than everyone else, so we should be able to dominate other species. So you know, to me, that the sorts of moral arguments, I'm comfortable with that sort of domination there. So in that sense, you know, seeing animals as you know, our fellow earthlings, and I don't need to eat them, I don't need to hurt them, so there's no need for that. So I can enter into some sort of solidarity with these other animals, and we need other animals on this earth in terms of keeping the biosphere stable for us, and also as a value in itself. And that this is an idea that's been long part of socialist movements, and, you know, sort of our allied movements going back to the French Revolution. There's sort of a weird number of vegetarian sympathetic socialists. It tends to go with the same groups of people who are sympathetic to, you know, gay liberation, et cetera. There's sort of this, these allied concerns of liberation that go with the socialist movement. So I think other socialists should be open to this sort of idea.
Great, thank you. So I guess you're saying there are the practical and urgent reasons for addressing the climate crisis, they join together, or they support the moral reasons for not eating meat.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's more of a personal biography for me. I mean, I think that those reasons are somewhat separate. I know many scientists who avoid eating meat purely for climate reasons, and they might even be somewhat dismissive of moral arguments for veganism, although that's not super common, I would say. So biographically, like, I think I was like most people in that, you know, maybe I react sort of negatively to people who are, I used to react negatively to people who are vegetarian or vegan in a sort of defensive way. And then, you know, once I was already vegetarian, I became open to those arguments. It's sort of adopting the practice opened me up to these moral arguments, because they are hard arguments to hear, I think. If you're, you know, used to eating meat, and you've not, you know, I think to some people, eating meat just registers as wrong. And I think for most people, it doesn't immediately register as wrong. I think in part because we're not doing the killing of the animals or something. It's sort of alienated from us, so we don't experience this. So I think it was only after I had already kind of let my defenses down a bit by becoming vegetarian that I was open to those moral arguments. So I don't know how universal that is. They're sort of separate motivations, but for me, you know, adopting one led me to be open to the other.
Yeah. And I guess also the propaganda in society about meat is good for you and meat is the protein we need, that's so pervasive that it's hard for a lot of people to see through that. I think Stephanie.
Hi, Drew. I'm Stephanie. Hi. And I'm also one of those weird vegan socialist people. So both Mary and I are both vegan and socialist. And for me, it's so intertwined. And I'd be really curious because, like you, I think most people go onto a journey to get here. Most of us aren't born vegan and socialist. We have to do a lot of deconstructing and then reconstructing a worldview. Like, what sort of, I'd be just really curious about your story. How did you get to where you are now?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I am from Alabama in the U.S., so southern U.S., from a family that's been in Alabama for a long time. I was raised religious, not evangelical exactly, but definitely, in a environment that was, sympathetic to those things. But I was in a very open-minded family that I think had a very various intellectual traditions behind their Christianity. And I think I was sort of raised with a certain, Christian ethic of morality. And I'm not Christian anymore. But I think this idea of, treating everyone equally, like we're all the same. There's a tradition of Christian socialism as well, one of these other weird socialisms that are out there. And I think that made me be quite open to, when I was in high school, this was sort of when the first Bernie Sanders run at the end of high school, start of college. That was when the first Bernie Sanders run was happening, really in high school. And so I think, this sort of general interest and that led me to be quite interested in socialism. And then in college, I dug in deep and became part of activist movements and read a lot and took classes and got connected with people. That's sort of my biography there. I spent a lot of time organizing in Democratic Socialists of America, which is, and in my graduate student union. So I've been a part of these movements in that way. So I guess there's something moral or whatever that was there. So, I mean, I think a lot of people come to socialism for some sort of moral conviction or some feeling that something is wrong. And it can come from many, many places. I think that's how it was for me.
Yeah, great.
Sure. Yeah. So I guess I wanted to kind of jump in by, I want to kind of hear about going with the one of the prepared questions. I mean, can you give us a bit of an overview about your main contentions in the book you wrote with Shroy Rites? And can you define what is meant by half-earth socialism?
Yes, great. So this book is, it's a strange book. So Troy, my co-author, is a historian, environmental historian. He works on neoliberalism. So he is a historian of economics. He's a Marxist, a socialist. But he is very interested in studying our enemy, these neoliberal thinkers, getting really deep into that. In particular, he's worked on neoliberal economic thought. And then I come from a scientific background, but also, very interested in reading about socialism, reading my Marx, et cetera. And Troy and I met, and we were both dissatisfied with what we thought were overly vague eco-socialist ideas that were kind of out there. We thought that often things were just there was a vagueness to the debate. People would say things that were sort of feel good, like, maybe we should consume less or something like this, et cetera, et cetera. And me and Troy were like, how much less? How could we can we like get into a concrete debate? How might we think about how to argue about what we should consume, right? Like we're kind of opening up a bunch of, you know, when you start getting into these environmental ideas of limits, et cetera, you know, things can get quite contentious quite quickly. And we wanted to have, is there some framework for us to productively argue about this rather than what we saw, which was, you know, some sort of vague, you know, feel good, like let's do less and maybe we can love each other more. And then on the other side, some socialists being like, no, we should build as many nuclear power plants as we can because the working class really wants to have as many cars as they can, et cetera. And so things were like, I mean, this is still pretty much the state of the field to some degree, at least in the US. And it was very frustrating. So part of what we wanted to do in Half Earth Socialism was to try and bring back this idea of democratic economic planning. So this idea that, you know, we as people, we should decide how the economy works. We should decide what we produce and what we invest in and where our economy goes and what the jobs should be, et cetera. That should be our decision. It should be the decision of a bunch of billionaires, et cetera. This is, you know, very old socialist argument, right? Like instead of the anarchy of capitalist production, we should have, you know, some sort of, you know, community of free producers, et cetera, who come together and decide these things. And so Troy and I thought this was a really nice way of thinking about environmental crises because, you know, we could actually get into what would the economy look like, what possible arrangements of organizing the economy might achieve different goals, among them environmental goals. And so this is where we kind of go back to these socialist thinkers from the early 20th century who are thinking about this quite concretely. And what we found was there was this philosopher named Otto Neurath. He was in Vienna. He was a part of the German Revolution. So during 1918, 1919, there was a briefly lived socialist council republic in Bavaria in Germany. And Neurath, this Austrian kind of genius figure, was appointed its head planner. And he had these ideas of trying to involve people in planning the economy. And he had this idea of planning in kind. So rather than trying to have money and budgets, we're going to actually just say, we want to build these roads here, and we have these reasons for it, and it's going to cost this in terms of labor, in terms of material. And we can compare that blueprint to other blueprints of how we use our resources. And his idea is that rather than comparing some sort of overall metric like money, we can actually go down to the thing itself and compare multiple kind of incommensurate views of possible futures. So he liked to talk in terms of blueprints. So maybe one group would propose one blueprint, which would involve building a lot of public transit in the city. Another group might propose another blueprint involving building a bunch of roads, and we can compare them and debate them and then come to some sort of consensus about what vision of the future we go down. And we don't compare it in terms of, you know, these sort of ideological constructs of money, et cetera, but instead we can go down and actually see what we want and talk about that. And, you know, Neurath's idea was sort of not fully realized at the time, but it was really striking to us because it seemed to cut through the noise of these environmental debates. We could actually be like, what, you know, if we want to reach certain climate goals, what would a blueprint where we cut our energy consumption by a certain amount look like? And what would that require? And so it made things this nice practical way of thinking. So there's that sort of planning element, and we developed that idea to some extent. And the actual title, Half Earth Socialism, is a reference to this idea of the half Earth from the biologist E.O. Wilson. This is based on his work, and it's the work of some other biologists on what are called island biogeography. The basic idea is that the biodiversity of an area is proportionate to its like landmass, to its total area. An island that's bigger will have more species on it than an island that's smaller. And there's a scaling law that goes with this. And this was applied to nature preserves. And it stood up to quite a lot of conservation biology research, sort of a foundational finding in conservation biology, which is the more land you have that is intact in some sense, the more species that are going to be there. And E.O. Wilson basically scales this up to saying that if half the earth was wild in some sense, some sort of natural environment, we could preserve 85% of the species on earth, whereas where we are now, we're going to lose quite a lot of biodiversity. So we are taking what we like this title. We like this idea because it shows the materiality of an environmental crisis. So mass extinction, we're living in a mass extinction event right now, is a crisis. It's a crisis that we think is very important on the scale of climate change. And it's a crisis that has a sort of material footprint, in the same way that climate change is a material footprint in our energy systems. And it allows us to say that if we take it as a value that we want to stop the mass extinction, the cost of that value is setting aside this land, and that requires a conflict with that animal agriculture I was talking about earlier. That's sort of motivating this sort of, you know, that blueprint style thinking. Now, we're also quite critical of, you know, colonial conservation, including E.O. Wilson. There's many problematic conservationists. We can talk about that if you want. And so we kind of deconstruct this idea and try and figure out these conservative and colonial elements and extricate them. But our point is that as socialists, we should have a policy or a thought around mass extinction and biodiversity loss, and we should have a response to it. So hopefully that's not too rambling. You can see that this book kind of covers a lot of material. It includes some fictional components. It's quite an unusual book, and I hope people enjoy reading it for that reason. But that those are some of the key themes.
Thanks, Drew. Yeah, and so for our listeners, you're listening to 8:55 AM 3CR, and we're currently interviewing Drew Pendergrass, who is co-author of Half Earth Socialism. So, Drew, you talk about democratic decision making, and you have this to say about this: democracy is a mere side effect of a socialist economy. And if you do not have a say in how the economy is consciously planned, then even the most technical and ecological planning will degenerate into tyranny. So it's a really curious quote there. And I guess with that as well, just that, you know, there may be some critics who say that the interests of workers and poor farmers in Asia will not be respected. But how would you respond to them?
Yeah, this is a really important question. And this is actually, Troy and I are at work on a second book that's going to delve into this sort of, you know, democratic side of economic planning in much more detail. And that's going to hopefully come out soon. But, you know, briefly to this, you know, it's, you know, this philosopher I was mentioning, Otto Neurath, who had this idea of these plans, he had a certain technocratic element to how he thought about how these plans would be made. And this is partially a function of when he was living. But he kind of had this idea that a bureaucratic or technocratic kind of group might put together these plans, like handle these expert decisions, and then produce these blueprints that would then be voted on or debated by people. And we are somewhat critical of that. In that we think that, you know, people, you know, who are affected by these plans should be the ones making the plan. And that's a topic that we're going to deal with a lot more in our second book. How do you balance expertise with democratic participation? These are quite old questions on the left, honestly. They come up all the time, from things like AIDS activism to you know, Black Panther Party doing medical care. This idea of ordinary people and experts, how can they relate? I mean, these are quite complicated questions. But to us, it is very important that ordinary people are involved in the planning process to a great extent, not just consulted, but involved deeply in the creation of that. And that's for, you know, moral reasons, and that, like, I think, you know, I believe in democracy, but it's also for practical reasons, which is that if you come in from the outside with a plan that says, okay, you all have to leave this area because we've decided we want it for conservation, that's, you're basically going to have to coerce people with violence for that. And that's tyrannical in some sense, right? Like in a very technical sense, that's sort of tyrannical. Mm-hmm. And this is not to say that there's no element of coercion that might be necessary, but it is to say that we really need to involve everyone. And if we're going to be doing big projects to save the environment, there needs to be consensus, right? And that's a political process. We need to, you know, make the case for this and win people over. And sort of our gambit is this transparency of how a plan might work and be like, we'll get this stable biosphere in exchange for giving up some of this consumption. We can do it in a way that's fair. Maybe that could win that consensus. But that process is necessary, because otherwise you're going to end up, I think, in a pretty unpleasant situation.
Thanks, Drew. I actually, just before I go to the next question, I was going to say what I, one of the things I loved about the book was the chapter which, the fiction chapter which looked at what socialism could look like. I thought that was just excellent and really important. So thank you for including such a chapter. But my next question goes to the fact that I have a lot of friends in the environmental movement that are demoralized, and they say, you know, oh, it's all too late, and the best we can do now is just get ready for survival or adaptation. There's a quote in your book which is something like, there is still time to reverse the decline of the biosphere and simultaneously create a just society. Can you elaborate on that, please?
Yes, I am sympathetic to people who are, you know, depressed at this moment. I mean, I think there's a lot of depressing things about, you know, this political moment. You know, I'm calling in from the U.S. A lot of depressing things happening there. And obviously, you know, the climate crisis is getting worse and it doesn't seem to be turning the corner. But I admit that I do get kind of annoyed at the sort of throw in the towel move that sometimes it seems like people do. And the reason is that the left, and then I would say liberatory movements in general throughout time, are often confronted with very unpleasant and defeated looking circumstances. And we can always, I think we always can make it better, right? Like, I mean, in the same way that, you know, I don't know how much warming we're going to see in the future, but limiting that warming, even if it's beyond 2 degrees Celsius or whatever goal that we want, it'll still be worth it, because 2.5 degree climate is much better than a 2.6 degree climate. Every bit matters. Every species that we lose matters. Yeah. In the same way that every life spent under a capitalist domination is also, you know, important. So, I mean, there's always more, you know, always more to do. So, you know, we can lose battles, and these battles can be, you know, we can mourn those losses, but, you know, people in our tradition have been in bad circumstances before, and obviously our environmental crisis is sort of unique in some ways, but it's also not unique to be defeated. And I think we do have an obligation to keep fighting, because there's always going to be more things to save, even though we might lose things too.
Great. The last question, I think. I love the way that you begin the book. I've already said, you know, the imagining the future is really great. But in the introduction, you actually imagine the world if we don't take serious climate action. And so you write about the rise of factory farming as one of those things, and how it can wipe out the remnants of peasantry and driving them into slums. This is something that I think some of us perhaps don't generally consider, the implications of the meat industry on impoverishing the working class and other poor groups under capitalism. So do you agree, and what can we do about that?
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, this is one of the oldest tricks in capitalism's book, right? One of the things that Marx writes about in Capital Volume 1 is about this clearances of the Scottish Highlands, right? Like these, you know, peasants who were in the Scottish Highlands for many, many generations were extricated from the land and replaced by, you know, sheep, etc., who were more productive from the perspective of capital, right? So these Highland clearances, which were extremely violent, that sort of process is continuing to this day, right? Like this landmass that I'm talking about that's taken up by agriculture, you know, growing plants for humans is a tiny fraction of that. And that's the vast majority of peasant production in general. There are certain areas where people are dependent on animals predominantly, but that's the exception, not the rule. but you know, basically this process of, you know, taking you know, land from peasants, or, you know, this is happening a lot in Latin America, right, with these deforestation drives, you know, and this beef movement is a very big part of, like, the Bolsonaro political project, you know, basically pushing people off land so that you have these cows. And from the perspective of capital, cows are fantastic because you can feed them corn that you grow, or you can feed them some grass, and then they can produce something with, you know, this kind of culturally prestigious use value, right? Like the steak, right? Like this masculine, you know, protein or whatever. You can win quite a lot of consent by making that available. So, I mean, I think this process has happened over and over again. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's something I would say. You know, the meat is eaten by the rich part of the world. That is who eats meat. You can look at meat consumption charts. It's similar to fossil fuel consumption. It's one of these highly unequal impacts on the environment, and those have material costs because that meat comes from somewhere, and someone was removed to get it there.
Great.
Actually, we have a bit of time to do another question, Drew. So I guess I want to kind of go into this next kind of question, because I think this is sort of, I mean, this is sort of part of a bit of the bigger kind of discussion within eco-socialist kind of politics. And I think it's something that is also quite distinct with eco-socialist politics, especially when you look at the ideas of, you know, people like Ian Angus John Bellamy Foster, and also quite recently Kohei Saito has sort of also looked at this. And I think at the start you also talked about this, because I think I definitely kind of agree with you about this, you know, the kind of within the left, there has been a section of the left that has sort of promoted this sort of idea of kind of anthropocentrism, especially in terms of like ideas like, okay, you know, we can have unlimited consumption under communism and so on. And so I guess I want to kind of conclude with, you know, asking you a question, I guess, in terms of eco-socialist politics, why it's important to confront anthropocentrism?
Yeah, this is a really good question. Yeah, and you're bringing up sort of these wonderful developments in eco-Marxism, right? This trying to take, you know, Marx, who I think really was sort of a productivist in some sense, in that I think he really did think that communism would, you know, get rid of some of the irrationalities of capitalism and unleash quite a lot of productivity. But Marx is a complicated figure, and he's always revising his thought. And there are quite a lot of ideas in Marx that can kind of be, you know, used and developed for ecological ends. And that's what a lot of these great writers have talked about, especially the very late Marx. So the Marx post Paris Commune is really rethinking, you know, how we could get to socialism. He's really rethinking different ways of living. He kind of has this openness, and he's always been an open figure, but he gets, I think, more open-minded, and they really dig into this. And I think this is an important move within socialism, because it, you know, it kind of makes Marx alive again in some sense. It makes him what he was, which was a person who had many different views and changed those views. And I guess taking that to this idea of anthropocentrism, etc., I mean, I think the other term that I hear bandied about is eco-modernism, right? This idea that, you know, with technology we can, you know, and maybe a change in social relations, right? Like maybe in communism we can have so much technology that we can relate to the earth in a way that fully, you know, we can build whatever we want and we can power it with solar panels or something like this. And I think there are some problems with this. I have a lot of technical problems with it. I don't think it's physically possible to build that sort of world. I think it would be very hard to give everyone the American standard of living and power with solar panels. I actually don't think that's possible. So there's that element, but there's also the element of questioning our desire to some degree. Like, do we want to give everyone that, you know, a Ferrari in every driveway or something? Why would we want that, right? And I think that's really valuable. And that's a current that's also always been present in socialism, right? Like this, this questioning of why is it that we want what we want? Is this conditioned? Like, is it coming from our social arrangements? What would it be like to desire more freely? Maybe we want something else, something other than more stuff. Maybe we want, you know, relationships with other species or something, or maybe we want free time, or maybe we want relationships and all these things. Like, maybe those things are what we want. And I think that's a very important part of the socialist tradition. And, you know, obviously there's quite a lot of politics in this. And you know, if you're running a campaign in your city, you need to be attentive to where people are, where they're at, and, you know, what you want to politicize in that campaign. But I think in general, as socialists, it is part of our project to question whether the desires that are created under capitalism are actually the things that we really want, or maybe we want something else. And so I think that that part of eco-socialism is incredibly productive, because I think it is bringing back this tradition's been around in socialism, but making it really bring it to the fore and being like, if we can't, you know, build a bunch of machines to give everyone, you know, a Ferrari, maybe we need to think about what it is we really want. And I think that is a really important discussion to have.
So, any other last questions, Jacob or Stephanie?
Oh, well, if you have any concluding comments you'd like to make, Drew, feel free to make them.
Well, I mean, thank you all for having me. And yeah, I don't know if I have anything else to say, but good luck in all your work.
Thanks, Drew. It's been such a pleasure to have you on this morning, and really fascinating too. So, yeah, maybe we'll meet sometime. And all the best to you and Troy.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Drew.
Bye.